Hi, it's Karen Webster, and welcome to The Matchmaker Is In. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by Peter Harrison, the president and CEO of Snagajob. Peter, thanks for joining me today.
Hi, Karen. Great to be with you.
So, Snagajob is a marketplace that matches 80 million hourly workers with 300,000 employer locations. It was established 17 years ago before this whole idea of the gig economy became a vocabulary word. I know, Peter, that you've been with Snagajob now for about 5 years, not part of the founding team, but know a lot about how it started and what problem it was intended to solve. So let's start there. What was the problem that was observed 17 years ago that Snagajob was created to fill?
Well, so a great question. I think the origin of the business back in 2000 was really, was as the name suggests, why does it take so long to get a job, especially a job that may be just a way to pay the bills for now and not necessarily a career. And so it really did start around that simple premise. I think the founder was trying to help a friend apply for jobs just to slot in around college class schedules. And the process was incredibly arduous, long, complex application processes for jobs that really shouldn't require such an extensive process. And so it was really started around the need for being able to find and apply very quickly for more lightly skilled jobs where maybe you don't have a big resume of experience that you're sharing. You're really just more sharing who you are, and it's about area, availability, and attitude.
Got it. So it was designed to simplify what could be a very cumbersome process. Marketplaces often do that, bringing supply and demand together in a more expedient way. When the marketplace started, though, it sounded like it was college kids looking for jobs. Were there any particular sectors that were targeted initially? There's often an ignition strategy for these matchmaking companies, and I'm curious to know what it was for Snagajob in the early days.
Yeah, so certainly to begin with, it was reaching out to the big hourly employers, people who hire, trying to hire large numbers of hourly workers, lightly skilled hourly workers. And so that tends to be the big restaurant chains, the big retail chains, to some lesser extent, perhaps big hotel chains. But it's these big employers that are hiring. You heard, Target is taking on 100,000 just for this holiday season alone. So those kinds of employers that are really looking to hire very, very large numbers of people, very often in a short period of time, particularly around seasonal hiring, maybe summer months or holiday hiring in the winter.
So what does the marketplace do for the employer? Obviously, create a supply of workers, but do you vet those workers? Do you certify their suitability for filling the job? How far does the marketplace go in creating or presenting an hourly worker to an employer?
Yeah, so when we started out, we really were just a supply of candidates. And that's really all we did. And actually, we really just sold on your location. Mm-hmm. And, over the years, much more sophisticated matching algorithms that now take into account availability and attitude, but also starting to gather much richer data so that we can really help present and sell a prospective worker to the employer, but also help the employer qualify the candidates. So it's really been a journey of adding and enriching that data and also the algorithms that match the two parties. And it really is a matching in both directions. It's not just about making sure the employers are seeing the right workers, but also, of course, that the workers are seeing the right employers.
So like any platform, you need workers and employers in this case, but you probably needed employers to sign on before you could actually get workers interested. How did that initial process go? And speaking with the founders, how difficult was it to get employers to sign on, or was it just, what the heck, what do you have to lose if you don't get any candidates? There's nothing that you've lost other than an opportunity to be present on a platform that's trying to do something new.
Yes. So, I think this is definitely a case of serendipity and timing. You know, good fortune. The company founded in 2000 was just at sort of the height of that, you know, we've got to get to the web. And the time, still so many jobs were being advertised on paper in classified ads and so forth. So there was a bit of a feeding frenzy around, okay, let's go online, let's test this out, let's try it out. And again, the core differentiation for Snagajob was the audience we're really focused on is looking for this this likely skilled work, is hourly work. So we're kind of bringing a different audience to the employer. So that was a big part of our calling card on employers, is you're looking for, you know, probably a much younger demographic, but also, you know, a demographic that isn't necessarily going to have an expansive resume.
What do you know about the workers who are part of your marketplace? Is this a way of life for them? Are they using your platform to fill in full-time jobs that they have? Is this still for college kids looking to make extra money? What's the profile of the worker?
Yeah, so they do definitely, they feel that, you know, they fall into really three buckets. There definitely are people who are using it to sort of pay their way to the point where they have a full-time job or a career. And so, you know, that's people who are using it to pay their way through school or mm-hmm. sort of in between jobs or you know, to augment their income. There's the second category, probably the second largest category, frankly, is people who are actually using it towards the end of their career to sort of extend their retirement and maybe augment Social Security. And then the third is people who have a career in hospitality, who have a career in restaurant retail, and this is a market that's been around a long time, that works now with, you know, a lot of the major employers and is well known and trusted and has become sort of a destination site for this group. So it's really, you know, those three groups.
Got it. You've mentioned now a couple of times attitude as one of the important determiners of a successful match between a worker and an employer. What do you mean by that?
So when you're hiring somebody for a lighter skilled job, you know, very often people who, you know, either have no experience or very little experience, you're hiring not based on what they know, but based on what they are. And mm-hmm. and what they are is you know, a set of behaviors and traits and attitudes that sort of, you know, make that are part of their makeup. So it creates a very interesting opportunity for us where a lot of companies that are dealing with knowledge workers may be testing on what you know. Mm-hmm. We're really looking more for the personality of the individual and what their traits, what their personal traits are, and that's really what we're using to drive the matching. Beyond once we've determined they're close and they have the right hours, then that's the third and sort of most important ingredient.
So, So walk me through the process. I have to say I didn't get quite as far as actually applying for a job, but I did, you know, I did see that I could choose my particular job type and I could choose my geography, and I was presented with a very nicely curated list of appropriate jobs. So should I, if I had hit on the apply button, what would have happened next?
Yeah, so a variety of different options, but you know, perhaps the simplest is you're presented with a series of photographs where you identify yourself in those photographs.
Huh.
You simply click me or not me, me not me.
Wow. Okay. So what's an example? Like I'm a sloth or I'm a tiger?
I don't know if we have the sloth. I think that might be a bit too obvious. What we're really trying to draw out is more subtle ways of indicating your personality traits and who you are and what you're drawn to.
So suppose a candidate chooses the wrong things. Is it all or nothing, or are there different degradations of profile that still ends up matching someone with an employer? I'm just curious to how that works in the end.
Oh, absolutely. So there's no wrong answers with these profiles. They're just a way of helping improve the likelihood of matching.
Got it. So you've been part of the platform now for 5 years, you know, presumably to build on the foundation and scale. And I understand that there have been a number of things added to the core to make it more robust for both workers and employers. Give us a little sense of what's evolved since you've taken the helm.
Yeah, so the first 10 years or so of the company, it was really about the match, and it was really about connecting the worker with the employer. But they sort of then handed it off to third-party tools to for the rest of the journey. And what we've done over the last 4 or 5 years is really build out a much more robust set of tools to help manage the funnel for these employers who are dealing many times with, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of applicants. So to help them really manage that funnel and keep track of people and make sure they're being responsive to those people and constantly improving and iterating. And they also include a series of things like interfaces with background checks or tax credit calculators or you know, immigration verification, those kinds of things that are required sort of in the funnel in the actual hiring process.
Got it. Do you take care of paying the workers? How does that happen? Are they working through your marketplace to be paid, or are they paid directly by the employer?
So in the core product today, we hand off to about 30 different payroll engines. So you know, all the usual suspects,
right,
where we just simply flow the information into a third-party payroll, and we have bi-directional interfaces with many of them as well. That's the core product, and that's the one that's used by all our clients today. We are piloting right now with a handful of clients an option whereby, as we work to sort of blur the line between snagging a job and snagging a shift,
mm-hmm,
we actually become the paymaster in that case, because you wouldn't want to have to go and onboard somebody and put them on your payroll if indeed all they were doing was just working for one shift.
So this is the Uber for hourly workers that we were chatting about before the show. Give us a little bit more context about what that includes, what that involves.
Yeah, so this is the idea that as you know, a lot of workers today, the problem is less about unemployment and more about underemployment. And there's a lot of
right,
people who have jobs but may not have enough hours or may not have them at the times they want or in the places they want. And so this is providing them an opportunity to sort of maybe augment the hours they have with additional leveraging the qualifications they have today, where, for instance, maybe they're a sandwich artist at a Subway and only able to pick up 20 hours, they'd like more hours. Why shouldn't they be able to go pick up more hours at another Subway down the road? Well, today, they would have to go physically and apply for that job all over again because it's a legally separate employer. But, you know, it would be extremely convenient if they could simply leverage their credentials as a sandwich artist to go pick up like shifts to round out their work schedule.
So in that instance, you've already done the pre-qualification, if you will, of their skills, suitability, and attitude to take on that other role. So the Subway that's giving this worker the additional 15 hours that he or she may want doesn't have to worry that someone that doesn't know how to put a sandwich together is actually going to show up for work.
That's right. And so this is a curated network. We've pre-qualified everybody who comes into this network, verified their employment and their credentials. But then the system takes over from there and enriches them, because every time they pick up a shift, we're capturing data about that shift, when they showed up, when they left, what their rating was at the end of the shift, and you know, badges that the employer can award the employee. And that data enriches their profile and allows them to pick up a broader range of shifts going forward, or may give them priority in future openings.
Interesting. So you're obviously dealing in a sector of the economy that's undergoing a lot of its own shifts and changes. You know, retail, it's no secret, is having its own struggles with sales and foot traffic and so forth. Restaurants, not as much, but depending upon the sector and the geography, feeling those pressures as well. What have you observed from the perspective of your marketplace in the supply and the demand of available openings and available hourly workers?
Yes, it's interesting. If you look at the three segments we focus in on, restaurant, retail, and hotel, they're arguably some of the most highly disrupted by technology right now. You know, Airbnb is disrupting hospitality. You know, Amazon is disrupting retail. And you know, a host of players, Grubhub and Blue Apron, and all sorts of players disrupting food. So they're being highly disrupted on all fronts. The interesting, and you know, not to mention sort of point of sales and, you know, some of these robots delivering room service and all of this good stuff. I think the interesting thing is, in the near term, it isn't actually diminishing the demand. It's probably increasing the demand, especially because, you know, a lot of these companies are having to compete, so they may be creating fulfillment centers where they didn't have to before to augment their retail operations, or they're opening more smaller stores, which actually are more labor intensive. So we have seen very little drop off. In fact, I have to say no drop off really in demand. We have definitely seen a shift in demand and different kinds of jobs that are maybe more highly prized, and so, you know, there's a change in the landscape of the jobs, but actually the demand for this lightly skilled hourly labor is at an all-time high. I think the one thing to note here is that increasingly every company that requires this lightly skilled labor is actually competing against on-demand companies, right? So whether they like it or not, they're competing with an Uber or an Airbnb for the very talent that they need. If you're a Domino's and you're looking for pizza drivers, well, guess what? It's got very, very hard to find someone to deliver pizzas now, because they're, you know, if they have a car and they have some time, they're probably on Uber or Lyft.
Yeah, no, it is interesting. We look at the gig economy on a quarterly basis and have been noticing some of the same shifts that you're describing. But since the demand is so high, do you think that that's related to the shift in composition of the workforce, you know, within the retail environment, the hospitality environment itself, less full-time, more hourly part-time to control the cost line of the business?
So that's interesting. We've definitely seen companies where that is the case. We've mm-hmm. also seen companies that have gone the other way and mm-hmm. opted to go to more full-time. I think on balance, there probably is slightly greater number that are going to part-time, but there definitely have been movements in both directions. Mm-hmm. But I think the thing that is really interesting is the growing desire by a lot of, especially the Gen X and Gen Z, desire to be on these platforms where you yep. have more flexibility. Yep. One of our largest grocery chain clients recently noted that they're losing workers for the first time to Instacart, which is a strategic partner of theirs, which makes mm-hmm. no sense because they pay 30% less, they don't have benefits and security. But these workers like the convenience factor of just being able to open their phone and find out what's available now, as opposed to sort of being locked into to a schedule, you know, 3 or 4 weeks out.
It's a very different mentality for sure. And you know, clearly these marketplaces provide that opportunity for the flexibility. But let's talk about benefits for a minute, because you know that is one of the important elements that these workers, whether you're an Uber driver or participating in your marketplace at Snagajob, don't have. Are you trying to help fill that gap? Is part of your platform providing access to benefits should workers want to take advantage of it?
So this is digging into, frankly, until now we didn't put ourselves with that because it was sort of that the responsibility of the employer. But now we are becoming a master in our own way. It absolutely is a factor.
Yep. It strikes me that at some point that will become important as millennials get married and have families, and you know, flexibility is still perhaps important, but so are healthcare benefits and 401k plans.
Yeah. So actually, you know, we're exploring right now, working with several other demand platforms to team together and sort of a possible benefit of sorts, where than just simply being on or off. You accrue benefits based on the hours you work. And so I think there's some very opportunities there, especially you know, as we try to collaborate with more companies where you could imagine a scenario where, you know, of the major platforms team to you.
Mm-hmm. Peter, one of the things we haven't talked about in the few minutes we have left is how you make money. What's your business model?
Yeah, so in the core business, it's simple. You know, employers pay to be introduced to workers and to, you know, access the tools that they use to qualify them. The new model whereby people pick up shifts, we will and we are simply taking a small slice of the payment. So if we pay the worker, if the employer pays us $15 an hour, then we may you know, process our payments and pay the worker $13 or $14 an hour. So it's really a take on a small slice off the payroll itself.
Got it. And you mentioned that you're paying these workers instantly. Is this obviously, it seems like an important dimension to getting a workforce on board. Are you pushing payments directly to their bank accounts or to cards that they have? What are the options that you're using or making available?
Yeah, so today it's either ACH or pay card. Those
are
the two preferred mechanisms. But we do that within 24 hours of the worker working the shift. After the employer has confirmed that they showed up and did a good job, they get paid immediately, and then we turn around and collect that from the employer.
Well, Peter, I'm sure after this podcast, there'll be 1,000 people who will be ringing your phone or buzzing your email with all kinds of ways that you could do instant payments a different way. Forewarned is forearmed. But no, this has been a fascinating conversation. I mean, we do get so caught up in buzzwords and labels. The gig economy is a concept that's certainly been around even before the year 2000, when the internet made marketplaces certainly possible. I remember my mother used to sell Avon when I was a little kid growing up. I mean, that was a gig too. But
that's right. Yeah.
But it's interesting how technology has allowed these kinds of opportunities to evolve and for the benefit of both parties. And I think that's what's really important.
Yes, I think so too. I think so. It's definitely empowering on both sides.
Well, Peter, thanks so much for giving us your time and the benefit of your insights today. And best of luck with the Uber for hourly workers. We'd love to hear more about that after you've gotten it out of beta and have more stories to tell about it.
Karen, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure.
Thank you very much, Peter, and thanks everyone who listened today. Have a great rest of the day and a good week. Bye-bye.